So I guess I can skip this. These are people I have worked with during my PhD. Okay, so the outline of my talk is I will give you a very brief introduction to the methods I'm using, which are matrix product states. And after that, I will show you, if there is time, three different applications or three different subjects we investigated with these methods. First part here is basically many-body dynamics of lattice models. And in particular, we'll look at quenches in the XXE model and solid tonic excitations in all different kinds of lattice models. And that is the first part. And the second part, I will talk a little bit about how one can use this matrix product state to compute dynamical correlation functions. And we'll look at I will show you results for the so-called single impurity Anderson model. And the reason why we looked at this model is because it is one of the most important model you have to solve when you're doing dynamical mean field theory, to which I will come. And if there is time, I can also show you some IV curves of how one can arrive IV characteristics of such models using time-dependent matrix product states. Okay, so first we are looking at one-dimensional systems. Okay, so and we are using a matrix product state representation of the wave function. So you have some quantum state given in some computational basis. So matrix product states is basically all about decomposing this thing here into a suitable set of matrices. Okay, so you have a set of matrices at every side of your system. They have a dimension chi times chi. And at every side, there are d such matrices. There is a graphical representation of those things. Okay, so you have two matrix indices. These are these auxiliary indices. And a physical index, which is pointing downward. And with these preliminaries, you can basically draw this coefficient, which is approximated by such a set in such a way. So you're multiplying. So you're multiplying over summing over common indices, basically. Okay. And in our in the code I'm using a similar representation for operators, which is called matrix product operator representation. The only difference is that the local basis set is now a matrix instead of a simple state. But the formalism basically stays the same. So except what you have now here are these matrices. There are now, this has now two physical indices, one pointing upward and downward if you plot it in this way. And again, two auxiliary indices, and the full operator is such an object. So you sum over common indices and the physical indices remain unmatched. Okay. So the good thing about this matrix product state is that the Hilbert space structure is kind of translates into a kind of same structure for a matrix product state. So you can add these states and you can apply operators to them. Both of these operations increase the bond dimension. Okay, so for example, an operator application looks like that. This is the operator, that's the state. This increases your bond dimension. Okay, this thing here is again a matrix product state with a larger bond dimension. So you have to, if you want to do these operations successively, then you have to compress that state because the bond dimension grows exponentially with the number of applications of operators or additions. So we use a variational compression scheme, which basically makes an ansatz for a state with a smaller bond dimension and variationally minimizes the distance. And applications are, for example, special applications are, these are sparse matrix solvers for eigensystems. For example, Lanczos or Chebyshev expansion technique. And this is what I will show you later today. Okay, this is very brief. For example, how the DMRG is a way of finding ground states in terms of matrix product states. So you're basically minimizing the functional of your energy and you make an ansatz for your state in terms of such a matrix product state, so the variational parameters are the matrices. And you fix all matrices except one and vary it until you get a local minimum. Then you can move to the next site, and if you see back and forth, you will eventually reach a global minimum. Okay, so for dynamics, we're using the time-devolving block decimation. This is a very, the one advantage is that you can do it in parallel. It's easy to parallelize this method. And in the end, it breaks down to applying the operator, the time evolution operator for, we use, look at nearest neighbor or lattice models interaction lattice model's nearest neighbor interactions, and the whole thing breaks down to applying an operator, and you're decomposing. We're decomposing this thing into trotter using a trotter decomposition. So we're decomposing it into a local gates, and the time involution is done by successively applying these local gates to the matrix product state. Okay, so that's basically. I hope it wasn't, you all got the idea. Okay, so now let's move to the more interesting part, which is the physics. Okay, so in the next few slides, I'm going to talk about, or I'm going to show you results for a quenches in the X6C Heisenberg model. Okay, this is a very famous model. I guess all of you know it. It's described by this Hamiltonian. First, it's a spin model, spin 1/2. It's described by this Hamilton operator. There is a hopping, spin hopping, and a spin interaction with an anisotropy. It's called anisotropy delta. And this model is interesting for several reasons. And one of, I guess, the most important one is that it's integrable and can be solved by the beta ansatz. Okay, this is an interacting model which is solvable. So that is already interesting in itself. And the spectrum of this Hamilton operator contains so-called bound states. This has been put forward already by Hans Bethe himself, who actually invented the beta ansatz. And these bound states are states of bound strings, actually, bound spins. And the point is, so since the invention of this model and since Hans Bethe proposed that these bound states exist, there have been notoriously hard to observe in experiments. So there have been experiments who tried to see if there are these states really exist or if they are important in this model. And one more recent is a paper by Kono. And this is a paper where he's a theoretician. So he tried to analyze experimental data. So people did neutron scattering on a one-dimensional material, on a material which is presumably described by this X6C Heisenberg chain, one-dimensional. And they looked at neutron scattering and got, with neutron scattering, you can principle measure the structure factor. And these are these red dots here. And you can now do an analysis and ask you can calculate the structure factor exactly using the beta ansatz. Then you can do it either by including these string states into your Lehmann representation of your spectral function or by not including them. And if you do that, you get, of course, two different results. This blue line here is the result for a spectral function with these states included, and this blue line is without. And you basically see that, they are equally good in describing the results of this experiment. So this is not really convincing that these states are important. So we asked, or what we found was, it was accidentally also, quenches could probably be a method to see if these states exist. So quenches have been done for this model. There is a big body of work already, especially for global quenches, where people looked at thermalization and steady states and all that stuff. But we looked at local quenches. Okay, so we prepare a system in a ground state, and at t equals zero, we change one parameter of the Hamiltonian, for example. Or we apply a local operator, like a spin flip, at a certain site. This will then introduce the resulting state will be non-equilibrium, so it will be far from equilibrium and will evolve. If you do the evolution, then we'll see something will happen. Something happens. And most people have studied this with single site quenches, which means you're changing your system at one single site, for example, or one bond. A typical example is a spin flip in a ferromagnet. You take a ferromagnet and flip one spin, and then you evolve it in time, and you will see such a signal. It will go into the left and to the right. Okay? This is expected, I would say. Okay, so now what we did was we looked at longer quenches. This means what happens if you do not flip one spin, but two neighboring spins. Is there anything interesting going to happen? And in fact, yes, there is. So if you did, what you see here are different time evolutions of such an initial state for different interaction strengths. And let's start here. What you see here, this is an 0.5. What you see is basically the same picture as before. So there is one branch of propagation, actually. But now if you increase the interaction, you will see that there, at a certain point, there emerges a second branch. So this is a second branch, which is slower than, so there is something traveling at a different speed than the other particle. And if you increase the interaction more and more, you will see that eventually all the intensity is contained in the second, slower branch of propagation. And what you can show now by looking at the probability of finding, so this is, the point is this is actually a string, okay? So what you're seeing there is a bound pair of particles which is traveling along the chain. And you can verify that by looking at the probability of finding two particles at neighboring sites, the time-dependent probability. For example, indeed for this case, you will get something like that. So what you see is only the slower branch is visible, the faster one is away. So that means faster one contains only a single particle. The second one contains two bound particles which are traveling next to each other, or not necessarily next to each other, but they are bound. And for large G, yeah, I already said that this dominates. And you can verify this by looking at the speed of this slower branch here as a function of the interaction, which you can then compare to the beta ansatz results, and you will basically get a perfect agreement. And interestingly, if you flip three spins, of course, you will get three different propagation branches depending on your speed of your on the interaction strength. So there will be a third one. And you can also compare the third one to the theoretical calculations from beta ansatz. You will also get a very good agreement. And interesting is, for example, that the entanglement, if you look at the entanglement, you will see that every time one of those particles, this is, for example, for a three spin flip, every time one of those particles crosses a bond, it increases the entanglement by a certain amount. It's almost, it's not exactly the same, but approximately the same. Okay, so this is basically very simple stuff. So we then went on and wanted to ask the question, what happens if you put those strings into a background where other particles are present? So before it was basically a vacuum, right? There are two spins traveling, two up spins traveling in a down spin. This is basically two particles in vacuum. So we asked what happens if we introduce other particles from which these spins can, or these bound states can scatter. And to this end, we looked at the anti-ferromagnetic ground state of the Heisenberg model at some finite magnetization, not zero and not minus 1/2, somewhere in between. Okay, you have a finite number of overturned spins. And then we looked at the ground state. And the initial state was created by applying a very strong magnetic field at two adjacent sites in the system. And this forces two up spins to be there. Okay, so they are in the ground state, you force the spins to be there. And at t equals zero, you turn it off, and then you will see a propagation. And the question was, do we still see these bound states there? Okay. And so the result of this, that's what you see here. So these are again space-time plots. The left one shows the probability of the spin z component. The right one is, again, the probability of having two neighboring spins, time-dependent. And this one is, these are results for different magnetizations. This is, for example, for six up spins, sorry, in a 100 side lattice. This is, I think, for 24 up spins in a 100 side lattice. And this is for 36 up spins. And what we see is that these branches actually, so these string states actually are stable. So they are also there at finite density. So the scattering with the other particles does not destroy them. But you also see that eventually with increasing interactions, with increasing magnetizations, this branch gets more and more washed out. And for example, if you would go to zero magnetization, then you wouldn't see anything. And that is because at zero magnetization, these states actually, string states actually do not exist anymore. Okay, you can again now verify or trying to verify if these are real string states by looking at the propagation speeds of these different branches as a function of magnetization. And that's what you can see here. For example, this one is the green line is the propagation speed of a spinon excitation, which is a single particle excitation as a function of magnetization. And the dots here are the speeds of these faster propagation branch as a function of magnetization. And you will get a very good agreement. And similarly for the case of the two string excitations, you can also do a theoretical calculation for their propagation speed as a function of magnetization. And if you compare it to the slower branch, you will also get a very good agreement. And in the bipartite entanglement, if you look at this, what you will see is that actually their branch is still, so you still see these this step-like structure, but it's getting more and more washed out. So I think if you would go to very large times, which means a very large systems, then you would still see these step-like structures. But, well, that's basically beyond reach for our method. And if you, for example, do three spin flip, then you will get this result here. Okay, so we also, one point that was important for to us is that the question of integrability, because in experiments, for example, people usually have non-integrable models. They have, for example, traps and other effects which make the system non-integrable. So we analyzed what happens if you introduce such non-integrabilities by, we did two different things there. We applied the next nearest neighbor coupling with 1/10 of the nearest neighbor coupling. And we applied a parabolic field, so basically a harmonic trap. And in both cases, you see that there, the string stage actually survive. And this has, very recently, this has been realized in a cold atomic experiment. But what they do there is they use a two species Bose Hubbard model at, in the MOT phase, so very large interactions. And at this point, we can show that by second order perturbation theory, this model maps to a XXC Heisenberg model. And what they did, they actually realized the initial states I showed you in the beginning, so these very simple two spin flip excitations, and then let them evolve. And that's what you can see here. So this is the probability matrix Pij of finding two spins simultaneously at sites I and J. Of course, at t equals zero, you find two neighboring spins here. And this is symmetrically, okay? This is a symmetric matrix. So you find one entry here, and of course, one entry at the transpose, not transpose, but the corresponding position. And if you do the time evolution, we'll see a signal which spreads along this diagonal, okay? And if you do the simulation for these two species Bose Hubbard model, you see that you get basically it's not perfect, but it's a very good agreement. And okay, the second one is just basically the same quantity, just a connected correlation function. But interestingly, this is not the whole story, because there is apparently, so if they look at the lifetime of these two strings of these bound states, what they see in experiment is this line here, or these dots actually. So they see a decay. And this is inconsistent with results from the, if you look, for example, look at the Heisenberg model, and we look look at this probability of finding of this lifetime, then you would, this is the probability of finding such a string state in your system, you would see that it eventually saturates. And these are calculations for the XXC model. I redid the calculations for the two species Bose Hubbard model. And what you see is basically you get a small offset as compared to the true Heisenberg model, but this offset cannot account for this decay here. So it's still under investigation what's actually the reason for this decay. And probably we think that it's probably excitations, finite temperature excitations with which these string states are interacting somehow. Okay, so so basically it was the first part. So in the next few slides, so I move on this is basically a little bit of fooling around with lattice models. So we looked at solitonic excitations in lattice models. So we saw before that you can create these string states are very stable, these stable objects, okay? They are stabilized by their interaction. So if you, for example, put a cluster of, let's say, five particles into the Heisenberg lattice model, for example, and at large interactions, you will see that they are stable, they will not decay. And what we were interested in was what happens if we put in a particle and hit this cluster with this particle. And we looked at this for different lattice models, basically. So this is the setup, and this, for example, is the result. That's the initial simulation. Okay, so you see here a block of particles, and one particle is here and it's traveling towards this wall. So the question is, what's going to happen there if it hits the wall? Okay, and so that's actually the result. So this is for spinless fermions. This is is equivalent to a Heisenberg model, and so instead of a J, we now got a V. It doesn't matter. And what you see is the following. So first of all, we did not, for visibility reasons, we used a particle in a so-called Gaussian superposition. So that's not just a creation operator, which puts a particle there. It's a Gaussian superposition. And using this, you can kind of make the particle travel in a certain direction. And the particle travels along the chain, and as soon as it, at the point where it should hit the wall, what we see is that, first of all, there is no reflection, so the particle just goes, the signal goes into the wall. Inside the wall is, of course, transformed into a hole because the wall is already full. So if there is no backscattering, the signal has to go through as a hole. And at the end of the wall is, again, transformed back, and the signal is particle-like again. And so what came a little bit of a surprise to us was that we see here a shift by two sides. That was something we did not expect, because if you look at the classical analog of this experiment, what you see is you take a particle and you hit the wall. It's a Newton's cradle. So if you take a line of balls and hit it with another ball, then the ball that initially hit this line of balls stops, and one ball goes away from the other side, and not two. You would not expect that there is a shift by two sides. But it can vary. The explanation of this is basically that it's an integrable system, and you can reproduce this result even if you put only two particles, a cluster, if you put a cluster of two particles into a system and hit it. And it's also visible for smaller interactions. This is always quite strong interactions to make this cluster stable, but you can reduce the interactions, but the cluster is still stable, and you can do the experiment the same way. And the reason why for these results are basically, as I told you, these are conservation laws. For example, the shift by two sides can be easily explained because you have a lattice model where you have a nearest neighbor interaction. So initially you have kind of a particle here and a cluster there, and the particle travels, but it cannot touch the cluster because that would violate energy conservation. So it has to stop before, because if you touch the cluster, you are basically removing two boundaries, phase boundaries, or from your system, in which this is not possible. So there has to happen something before. So the particle has to stop one side before the cluster, and then something has to happen. And the point is, and apparently there is no reflection. And what we think the reason is conservation of energy current, because this model conserves the energy current. This is just the amount of energy which is current. And this is conserved. So if you have initially have a particle which is traveling through the right to the right, this has some finite energy current. If it got reflected, then you would have an opposite current. That means particles have to go backwards. And to accommodate for this, you would have to have something traveling to the right side which has even more current. For example, you could have two holes inside the wall, but then you would again violate the energy conservation, because then you would again create boundaries between different kinds of flavors of particles, and this is not possible. So we think that this is basically a result of conservation of energy current. So what we do not know is if this is already enough, or if higher energy laws are important for these results, or are needed to reproduce them. And if you look at the bipartite entanglement again, you will see that this whole thing is basically classical. So you got an initial state which is entangled because it's a Gaussian superposition. That's this thing here. This is the wall, or the cluster, however you call it. And the particle basically, or the signal basically, travels through and does not, so there's no entanglement between those two in the end. So it's classical. So you can look at it like this. It's basically a particle which is traveling along the chain, at a certain point stops, makes by some mechanism move the particles inside of the cluster to the other side, and at the end the last one then travels in the same direction. And also it's also interesting that this signal here jumps whenever it hits a boundary. So there is a jump by one side, and there is again a jump by one side. So at large interaction strength. So the total jump is by two sides when the particle travels all along this, through this cluster. And if you now look at the integrability, we can break the integrability of this system by applying a next nearest neighbor interaction. And if you do this, you will see reflection. So the particle gets partially reflected and partially transmitted. Same happens again there. At the end, there is a signal traveling to the right side, and you can now do a projection. You can look at the state after the particle has traveled here, and you can project it onto the space where you have one particle here. So this is what you see here is the density or the SC component or SC expectation value on the condition that a transmission has occurred. That what is, and we see that, so there is no backscattering. So this backscattered signal is away, and that suggests that the state is basically a very simple superposition. It's just a transmission plus a reflection. So there is nothing more that happened. Okay. For the Fermi and the Hubbard, for the Fermi and the Bose-Hubbard model, these results are basically remain valid. For example, in the Fermi-Hubbard model, this is an integrable model. There are no stable bound states there, so you have to maybe do something else to get these states working, to get these clusters stable, large interactions, but you see basically the same result. An upspin, for example, hits the wall, gets transformed into a downspin, then transformed to an upspin again, the whole wall shifts by one side, which means two doubly occupied sides. And the same thing happens here in the Bose-Hubbard model, but you see there reflections. Okay, and then there are some toy applications, or some, for example, you can make an array of such clusters and then hit the particle with it, and you will see that the signal actually inside this array of particles travels faster than outside. This is because the signal jumps at every boundary by two sides. Okay. So so that's, yeah.
So how was the cluster of particles hanging together in the first place?
By their interaction. So they are bound by the interaction. For example, in the Hubbard model, in the Bose-Hubbard model, you can just put doubly occupied sites plus some U, and then they will stay. So there will be decay, but there is a finite part of the wave function which where the particles are bound for all the time. They will never decay. And this, it's similar in the Heisenberg model, for example, or in the spinless fermions. They are just bound by the interaction. They cannot move. So there will always be a finite overlap with a state where particles are clustered. And it's very, and so this is very, so the longer the cluster, the stabler, the more stable it gets, actually. Okay. So how much time do I have left? Okay. Then I'm too fast, actually. All right. So this is the second part of this talk. I'm going to, this will be a little bit more technical. Okay. So I will talk about how one can use matrix product states to compute spectral functions of quantum systems. And I use different techniques to do this, and I will talk about the so-called Chebyshev expansion technique, and which is where you employ so Chebyshev polynomials, which are have this form here. These are the first few, five or six Chebyshev polynomials to decompose the spectral function. Okay, so the thing we're interested in is this object here, spectral function for some Hamilton operator. So this is the ground state, and this is an accretion operator of a particle. And you can decompose this object by using a special representation of the Dirac delta function, okay? So this is fancy way of writing the delta. You get there a Chebyshev polynomial of the H and a Chebyshev polynomial of omega. You can do it like that. I mean, you can use a lot of different polynomials to get this representation. But anyway, we use the Chebyshev. So if you plug this into this equation, you get this one. And so what you see there is basically the expansion. So you got a Chebyshev polynomial Tn and expansion coefficients mu n, which are called moments, Chebyshev moments. And all the work goes now in computing these mu n's here, which are basically overlaps or expectation values of polynomials of the Hamilton operator. And what the way you do it is you employ a recursion. So these Chebyshev polynomials, they are orthogonal polynomials, so there is some defining recurrence relation. And you can use this recurrence relation to compute this object here. And the way you do it is by an iteration. Okay, so you start with a state T0 and a state T1. And then you iterate this formula here. And in the end, you can calculate the expansion coefficients as the overlap of the nth state with the initial state. That's it, basically. So there are some things you have to be careful about when you're using these Chebyshev expansion techniques. And one is that these Chebyshev polynomials, if you look at those here, they contain all the roots for if you have a Chebyshev of nth order, it has n roots, and they are all, is it n minus one? I don't know. Of anyway, they are all contained in the interval minus one and plus one, and all maxima and minima in the interval minus one and plus one, which means outside there is nothing more than either grow or fall to infinity. Okay. And that means also, and this also goes for the number of the for the order of the Chebyshev polynomial. Or for if you are outside the interval minus one, and you look at, for example, at omega equal 1.2, then this the Tn of 1.2 will grow exponentially, I think, with the order of the polynomial. So any if you want to expand a function outside this interval, the expansion diverges. So what you have to do is you have to introduce a kind of a rescaling, which rescales your spectral function in such a way that it's completely squeezed into this interval minus one and plus one, so that you can do this this recursion. Is there not? Okay, that's it actually. Okay, and what we did was, so we applied now this method to calculate spectral functions for the so-called single impurity Anderson model, which is basically the most, probably one of, not the most, but one of the most simple impurity models there are. It contains of a single interacting Hubbard site coupled to a bath of non-interacting fermions, okay? So it's not trivial, but it's simple. It's one of the most simplest impurity models there is, but it's non-trivial to solve, of course. So the reason why we looked at this is because in, as I show you later, we want to do dynamical, yeah. No, that's not necessary. So you can, you mean by periodicity, you mean what? No, you can, so you can use any, you can expand any function in these Chebyshev polynomials. The only thing is it has to be contained in the interval minus one and plus one. I mean, you can also, if you do Fourier, for example, you can also expand non-symmetric functions. Of course, in the end, you assume that they are, that this part is reproduced to infinity all the time. But that's, yeah. Okay. No, but that works pretty, it's pretty general. So you can calculate a lot of different spectral functions. Yeah. And so we looked at this impurity model, the single impurity Anderson model, because in if you're doing dynamical mean field theory, to which I will come, this impurity model is an effective model you have to solve for getting information of an interacting d-dimensional lattice model. Okay, and of course, I mean, this model was not developed for DMFT. It was originally developed to explain the formation of local moments in alloys with iron and gold, I think. I don't know, something like that. So there is also a physical, it's also interesting from a physical point of view. So the point is this bath here. So this is basically a d-dimensional problem. So you have to map it somehow to make it possible to treat it with MPS. And the way this is done is by you introducing a so-called discretization of the bath hybridization function, you call it here. So this here is the bath density of states. And this V squared is just a coupling strength of the impurity to these bath states. And this is very similar to the things that Wilson has done in his NRG. So you discretize the bath, and then you map it into a chain geometry. So in the end, you have something like that. You have an impurity, a coupling of the impure to the first site, and then there's just the nearest neighbor hopping from one site to the next. So this can be, this is straightforward to treat with MPS.
So in this case, P is constant?
No, that really depends on the exact structure of your spectral function, of your bath spectral function. It usually decays. You can make it, it depends. It really depends on the form of your discretization. If you, for example, use a logarithmic discretization, then it decays. If you use a linear discretization, no, it does not decay. I mean, it's not like it's constant. It's kind of making strange things, but it's not constant. And it really depends on the exact form of your function, of your spectral function. Okay, so the goal is why we did this was, as I told you, first of all, calculate spectral functions for four-dimensional systems. This is also already in itself interesting. But more important, we want to see if we can use it as an impurity solver for the dynamical mean field theory, because this dynamical mean field theory, there you have to solve this impurity problem. And the way people usually, there are quite some techniques out there, and the most important ones are those. So there is exact diagonalization, the numerical renormalization group, the dynamical DMRG, and quantum Monte Carlo. These are the four basic or the most important methods people use to solve this impurity problem. But they all, I mean, they all have their advantages, but they all have their shortcomings too. For example, the ED is pretty clear. You can only do small systems. You cannot go to large systems. And this severely reduces your spectral resolution because in the end, you just get a few peaks. You have to broaden them and you get something out which is very peaky, so you don't really know what's the meaning of that thing. The NRG, on the other hand, is a very precise and very fast solver, an impurity solver, if you look at zero frequencies or low frequencies. So it was basically designed for that, and it has a very high resolution there, but it has an intrinsic problem treating multi-orbitals. So if you want to have more than one orbital, more than one, we had one single orbital. If you want to have more, a local state which can contain, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 particles, then this gets pretty much unfeasible with the energy. And furthermore, for high frequencies, because you have to do a logarithmic discretization of your bath, this means that the bath is not good resolved at high frequencies, and this is very likely to affect the fixed point of the DMFT equations. And the dynamical DMRG does not have this problem, so the shortcomings, not intrinsically, for example, with multi-orbitals. You could do multi-orbital, but it's still, it's a very accurate, but if you do it, it's very heavy numeric. So you have to invert a possibly very bad condition or ill-conditioned problem. And this inversion can take very long, depending on some parameters you have in this system. And so people, I think, basically are a resort to QMC. This is the method most often used. And because it's fast and it's statistically correct, you know what you're doing. But it has the problem that you can only do imaginary frequencies. So if you want to see the spectrum, you do have to do a weak rotation, and this is max end. And this, by doing max end, you basically throw away a lot of information. Just don't, because you, well, you fit, it's a fit basically. So the Chebyshev expansion, as I showed it, has, of course, also its shortcomings. One is, for example, that you can only calculate finite order. That means you have a finite resolution. And what people usually, because of this finite resolution, you also get oscillation artifacts and all that stuff. And so what people do is they basically often use damping, so smooth their coefficients down, so you get rid of any oscillation. But the more severe shortcoming, I think, is the so-called energy truncation, because this is related to the MPS nature of the method, okay? So because you are, when you're doing these applications of operators and adding the states, you have to truncate the state because it grows. And this truncation is done in the eigenbasis of the reduced density matrix and not in the eigenbasis of H, not in the Hamilton operator. And that means you're basically reintroducing states with energies which are larger than one. They may have very small, so the overlap with these states may be very small. So they may have an amplitude of 10 to the minus 16 or 10 to the minus 15. But the point is, it's an exponentially growing problem. So there will be a point you will hit that wall, and then the simulations will be completely off. So what you have to do is you have to get rid of those states. And what people suggested in Munich was they tried to project them out by some Lanczos method. And so they looked for these states and project them out at every step in a DMRG-like fashion. The point there is, you don't know what you're doing there. You're basically changing your state, and it's a systematic error which is not controlled, in my opinion. Okay, so now if we calculate the spectrum with the Chebyshev, this is, for example, a simple example. It's called the resonating level model, where you can solve exactly this, or everything can be solved exactly. So just to illustrate you how this works. So these are the first 150 moments, then you plug them into the equation. If you do nothing, you will get this green curve here. So we get negative parts, for example, here. That's because these are these Chebyshev oscillations. Of course, you do not want them because it's unphysical. So you can use this damping. If you use damping, you get this dashed line here. So you lose the resolution. The red line is the exact solution for known. You can do it, an analytic calculation. Okay, so what we had, if you look at those moments, you're calculating all these moments all the time.
Sorry,
yeah?
Conclusion that this method is a disaster.
No, this just this that's basically to show you that what I should have put the other slide, I think, before. So what we do is, if you the point is, if you use these moments here, these few moments, you have, it's not good. You have to do something to get, either you go to very high orders to get a good resolution, or that's the point. What we did was we tried to extrapolate the behavior of the moments. Okay, you can do an extrapolation. If you look at how these moments behave, you will typically get something like that. So you have, this is the order of the moment. This is the, these are the moments. You see that these are basically damped oscillations. It's a Fourier. It's very, very closely related to Fourier expansion. So it's, if the function is analytic, you will get damped oscillations. That's for sure, right? There is a, and if it's not, you still get damped oscillations, probably not exponentially damped, but algebraically, but still damped oscillations. So the idea was, because people have tried this before, to use the linear prediction method to extrapolate these moments to high orders, because then you would get a better resolution.
But what you're doing is you're computing some number of moments and then see that they repose some pattern
mm-hmm.
and extrapolate.
Yes, basically.
Doesn't this mean that you are choosing the wrong set of polynomials in the first place? That there is a clear structure there that is not captured easily by those polynomials because you need.
You mean you should take other polynomials?
Well, I'm trying to interpret what it means that you know you have you have the ability to extrapolate this momentum. That's so you have to compute many momentum.
Yeah. Yes.
Many momentum, and then.
Yeah. It, of course, it means you're not. That means basically that this function is not a Chebyshev polynomial.
Well, that's
right.
Not surprising, but.
I mean, if it was a Chebyshev polynomial of some order, then at some point you would get, I mean, then you would get zero, and from, you know what I mean. So it's, yes, it means it's not expandable by a finite number of Chebyshev polynomials.
Well, it's not that it's not expandable, it's that it's not well approximated by a finite
yes.
number.
Well, yes, but you can show, for example, that for the Chebyshev expansion is, if you, I mean, it depends on, it all depends on the structure of your spectrum in the end, right? So you don't know that in advance. You have basically no idea what the spectrum
that
looks like. Yes.
Yeah. In that case, at least it looks like this expansion might not be the best one.
Actually, in this case, it is. You can show, because this is a Lorentzian peak, and you can show that the Chebyshev expansion is the one the expansion that converges fastest for if you're expanding a Lorentzian. I apparently, I think, yeah. So, so there is some, I mean, you have to, yeah.
So if I look this inset, that you said these are the moment.
Yes.
So you go to 150 or 2 times that.
Yeah.
And you still get the error of order 1 at minus 1.
Yes. Of course, I mean, this also depends, this depends very much on, you could use a different rescaling than you would probably need. Not so, it's a little bit more complicated, but I can explain it to you. There is this rescaling, right? You have to rescale your operator. If you use a very large rescaling, then you have to, this automatically means that you have to use a very high order of polynomials to get the same resolution as if you would use a smaller rescaling. So in this case, I used a rather, I don't know exactly, 10, 15, a rather large rescaling so that you have, I could have done better. I think you could have used less moments. The point is what I wanted to show you here is that these oscillations or these artifacts you get there, of course you can calculate more moments or do a different rescaling so that you would need less moments to get the same resolutions, but the problem remains the same. So that's basically what I wanted to show you there. Okay, so what did I say here? The linear prediction. So anyway, suppose you're given this data set, and what you try to do is to extrapolate those to large moments, so to somehow get a better resolution instead of damping, which reduces the resolution. And the linear prediction has been shown to be very well suited for time series, which are exponentially damped and oscillating. And basically works, you are given a data set, you take this data set here, and you're training, you're finding coefficients an in such a way that the data here can be optimally represented as a superposition of these data points weighted by these ans. And you can, this is a mean least squares problem. Once you have those A's, you can do prediction to an arbitrary order. Okay, so now this is now a benchmark. This is a benchmark, not yet a benchmark. This is now for this interacting SIAM, the single imperial Anderson model. These are the moments. So that's the way they look like. Okay, so what you see, they are damped, they are falling off, they are oscillations. So taking these as input, we used a split up in one-to-one split up of data into training window and data window. Then we do a prediction on those, and you get this spectrum here, the blue line. Okay. Let's look here. So if you would take this, I mean, computing these 400 moments is already takes quite some time, okay? So we did an extrapolation to 10,000 moments. And if you do that, you get this blue curve here. So computing 10,000 moments with this really it's a pain. It will take really long time to compute those 10,000 moments with MPS. Okay, so this will really give you some, it's good to do it, or it makes things much faster. Especially if you want to use DMFT, or use it in DMFT. So, and if you would use those 400 moments, you would get this object here, this green line again. The red line is again this use the function obtained by damping. What you see, and this is for example this left peak here, the Hubbard peak. It's called a Hubbard peak. And in the center here, you see that these 400 moments are actually already pretty good in resolving. This is kind of a Lorentzian shape bar, peak. So these 400 moments are actually already quite good in resolving it. So this means that this very long tail thing here is basically because of those sharp peaks. It's also not surprising because you need many high frequencies, of course, to resolve such a small thing, okay? And we benchmark this against the dynamical DMRG because there were calculations for exactly for these parameters, and that's the result. So the data points X's, should be X, are dynamical DMRG results from Uhrig, and we get an almost perfect agreement. I mean, it's almost perfect. I mean, there are, especially at those peaks here, there are differences. They are of the order of percentages. But if you, for example, look at the central region here, and that's here, you see that there is a sum rule. You know that the spectral function here at zero has to have some value, 2 in this case. And we see, what we see is that with this Chebyshev expansion, with this prediction, works really nice. So we get this sum rule very good, even better than the DMRG does, because they have to do some max entity convolution because they're using an intrinsic broadening. Okay, so now we did DMFT with this. So on this slide, I want to give you a very brief idea what DMFT is. Okay, this is called dynamical mean field theory. That's the long word for it. And what you want to do is what people do when they use DMFT is they calculate the spectral function A of omega of an interacting d-dimensional lattice, for example, a Hubbard model in 3 dimensions. That's what you want to calculate. So the point is a local, and it's local. They want to calculate the local spectral function. So the question is, you put in a particle into this lattice, let it evolve, take it out at a certain time later, and ask what's the probability of being able to do that. And of course, it's not possible in general. So the idea people had was to instead of doing this full evolution of this full lattice model, they try to find a bath of non-interacting degrees of freedom which emulate the effect of the full lattice. So instead of throwing in this particle and let it jump around in the full interacting lattice, you try to find a bath of non-interacting degrees of freedom which optimally, in some sense, emulate the behavior of this particle in this bath. Okay, and the way you do it is you have the parameters you are using are your bath parameters, these things here. So this is the so-called hybridization function, and this contains parameters. These V nus are the hopping strength of the impurity, because this is now an impurity problem, hopping strength of the impurity into this free bath, and these epsilon nu are the energies of the corresponding local non-interacting degrees of freedom. And now you vary them in such a way that this object, that you get a self-consistency, there is a self-consistency equation. You vary them until this equation is fulfilled, okay? So you're given some delta. From this delta, you calculate the G imp. This is the impurity Green's function, which is related to the impurity spectral function. And you try to vary them until you get this equation. Okay, this object here is the density of states of the original non-interacting lattice, and this is constant through all iterations. Okay, and for this is these are the results. If you apply this method as it in this way for to the Hubbard model on the beta lattice, this is a special lattice. It's a lattice of infinite connectivity. So every site has infinitely many neighbors. And the reason why one looks at it is it's exact. The DMFT gets exact results in this limit. This row of epsilon is in this case a semicircular, but the semicircular entity of states. And if you increase this U, what we see is you get a starting from a kind of a Lorentzian peak at U equal one with a small, we have zero small side peaks here. If you increase U, we'll get a formation of a so-called Hubbard peak. And in the middle, you have this quasi-particle peak. And this thing here is related to the weight of the quasi-particle in the corresponding Fermi liquid theory. Okay. If you would go to even larger interactions, this thing would vanish and you would have an insulator. So this is omega equals zero, so you have it's a metal. And one and these things here have been quite for some time been the issue of some investigation because people were not sure are they there or are they not there or are they not there. And I think from, I mean, there are DMFT results which also confirm the existence, but with a very conflicting results about their height and their sharpness.
Sorry, this was for a system at infinite dimension? So
yes. Connected with everyone, all the sides in- I mean, in the original lattice, yes. So it's a beta, the original system was the Hubbard model on the beta lattice.
So calling it a metal or something else is probably irrelevant, right? Because there are no bond structure. There is no, the propagation is from every side to every side. All the sides are equivalently connected.
No, it's not that every side is connected with every other side. It's one side is connected to an infinite number of other sides. And these infinite number of other, it's not like, you know, it's called this Cayley tree. There is, if you take two lattice sites, then there is only one way to go from that one to the other. One defined way. It's a tree. Okay. So there are not many different ways to get there. So it's a different. Yeah, probably, yes. But I mean, you can do the same analysis for example, a 3D Hubbard model. And you will get probably on for example, on a cubic lattice, and you will get the same result, or not the same result, but similar results. In this case, if you can talk of a metal. Okay, so so I already told you about the disadvantages of this Chebyshev expansion technique, which basically is this energy truncation. So the idea we had was instead of using a rescaling where you just divide the operator by a certain number, you can map, you can use a different mapping, because this mapping here maps the extensive spectrum of the operator of H into interval 0 and 1. So everything is contained in 0 and 1, so you will have no energy truncation, because whatever you do, you will not introduce states with energies bigger than 1. And the advantage of this is that also, from another point, is that this H of tau can be trotterized, and it's easy to apply it to a state. Okay.
I wish something about the H here.
Yeah.
The spectrum is contained between 0 and 1.
Mm-hmm.
Are you assuming something about H?
I mean it's put to zero. The ground state is at zero energy. So if the ground state is at zero energy, then let me see. Then this is from zero to infinity. If it's zero, then it's one, right? It's one minus one is zero. If it's infinity, it's zero. So it's one minus zero. Then it's contained in the interval zero and one. sorry, I forgot to say that. Yes. Okay. And if you do this Chebyshev expansion of this one minus e to the minus tau h operator, you basically get the same results, but you don't have to do an energy truncation anymore. This reduces the number of parameters. It also introduces another. It introduces the tau of your trotter expansion, but that's a control. It's better control, right? People know what you do when you're trotterizing an operator. Okay, and yeah, the results are basically the same. Okay, so there is one other. This is very recent work actually, which is. Is it already? Do I have?
You are into the question of time.
Okay, so then I will stop. This is a very recent work, so you can also use actually a computer spectral function using a real-time evolution, okay? Because the spectral function is that object here. It's just a time evolution, Fourier transformation of some time-dependent object. Okay, so we can use the TVD to compute that thing. And so it, in the end, it amounts to putting in a particle, evolving it in time, and computing this overlap. Okay. Then we are assuming particle hole symmetry, and there is some symmetry. So you, in the end, you have to compute only one of those, not both. And your Fourier transformation, and you can also use the linear prediction on this object here, okay? And if you do that and use it as a DMFT solver, you basically get. So first of all, why do it? The point is, this Chebyshev works, but it's still very expensive and it's not very fast. Now, using this, the time evolution method is much faster. So a single spectrum is computed in, I say, what, half an hour or so. And I, on the slides before, I show you results for 2.5. For interaction of u over d equals to 2.5. I wanted to do 2.8, but it was just not possible to stabilize it because it was so slow and hard to get there. And using the time evolution method is much faster. Okay, so if you, for example, if you do this TBD, you get for u over d equal 2.8, those results here. You see this sharp peak, not as high as people from the dynamical mean field theory expect them to be, but higher as energy, for example, tells you. So I really think that these are probably among the best data for the DMFT on the Hubbard model you can get. So yeah. Okay, so that's actually all I wanted to say. Fine, so and I can skip this part and go to the conclusions. All right, so.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm just curious how you compute that.
That's actually very simple. So you just have, the Hamilton operator conserves the total spin z component. So this is basically a problem of two particles in vacuum. So you just, there are several ways. I did these calculations because I'm so lazy with TBD and didn't, because you know they are exact using the TBD. So you just put in a particle. But you could also, we benchmarked it. Some guy wrote, for example, full diagonalization code. It just brute force, take your full. This is not much. It's two particles on 50. You can exactly do a calculation of 100 sites, two particles. That's not very expensive.
How do you see, the entanglement is it occupies this part in your lab? Yeah.
You mean that?
Right. In your lab, it's rather than
Oh, wait, you mean how I did these calculations?
I think you're asking what the plot means.
Okay, this is the the bipartite entanglement at every site as a function of time. Okay, so this is the position and this is time. So you know what bipartite entanglement is, right?
I see. So you basically just take out a small part of that.
Yeah, you cut it into two. No, you cut it into two. You cut it into two at this bond, and then you look how entangled those two sites are. So that's what's plotted here actually as a function of time. So at every side you cut, and then you look at the evolution of the entanglement, and you plot it in this way.
Okay, I see.
So I actually have a question about the string operator, the XXE.
String operator?
Yes. And so are there effects on the spectral function known to be small, or just the data that because you show two pictures that cannot really distinguish whether.
I'm not really sure about this. So I think that it's still I don't know much about the spectral functions. So that's basically all this data I showed you. That's what I know about this. But I think there has been some controversy about are these string states, for example, important in other experiments like heat transport or something like that. So I think it's still under debate. I'm not sure if it is expected that they are to be very important, but apparently they are not in this experiment. I'm not sure. I think I met. You mean this experiment? Oh, I have to look it up again. I can give you the reference if you want to. It was some kind of a quasi one-dimensional material, which was presumably described by this XXE model. Yes.
I guess you'll do this real time evolution, but I wonder when you're truncation, whether there's a unitarity may get lost. Do you see anything like that?
You mean if the truncation destroys the well, yeah, but that's something you can. Well, you can easily check this by just reducing the trotter decomposition, right? So you just have to check, is it converged in the trotterization parameter?
Yeah, but I just wonder, you know, if you run this a very, very long time, maybe things became...
Okay.
Because a lot of unitarity, then things may became...
I mean, if
you... You cannot trust it, but I just wonder at which time you can still trust this, and how do you see whether the last unitarity is a sphere or not sphere? That's basically the question.
The way you do it, basically, you can. I mean, if you can look, for example, if you know that it's non-unitary, so you're losing norm, you can look at the norm. You can look how does the norm decay. But most in these simulations, they was basically constant because. Yeah. You can also, there are these parameters. I mean, the good point is it's easily check convergence in all these parameters. You can introduce your matrix, make it larger, the matrix dimension. You can reduce the trotter expansion, and you can look at the convergence of your results. So this is something you can check. So this is from this point, it's a very controlled method.
Are there more questions? No, let me remind you that this week we have three visitors, I believe. This is the visitor center. So Martin will be here until Friday.
Yes.
Frank Coleman is visiting us also until Friday. Sushi is visiting us for the month. So Frank is coming from Dresden, from Max Planck in Dresden. And Sushi is coming from the University of Tokyo. Okay, so they are in room 461 and 463. Okay, all right. Thanks. Let's thank Martin.
Thank you.